You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
So the other day I was having lunch with my best friend Barb, and I mentioned to her that I was working on a very unusual story for my next podcast, and that's the story you're about to hear. Now, as any long-term listener of this podcast knows, I don't do a lot of true crime stories. And that's mainly because true crime podcasts are a dime a dozen. But every once in a while, I come across a crime story that's just so unusual, so unique, that I feel compelled to research it further. And if I really think it's worth telling, of course, then it becomes a story for this podcast. I explained to Barb that even though the coroner and the New York City Police Department worked to solve this mystery, I really wasn't sure if any crime had been committed. And after we discussed it a bit, I have to say, I'm still not certain. So what you're about to hear, a story that I've titled A Strange Case of the Poppy Seed Roll, it may or may not have involved a crime being committed. But either way, I'm quite certain that this is one that you will never, ever forget. I am Steve Silverman, and this is the Useless Information Podcast.
Useless Information.
As I've mentioned before, I lived in New York City until I was 7 years old, at which point my parents picked up and moved to Thompsonville, New York, which is a rural location in the Catskill Mountains. I always like to joke, if you blink, you'll miss it. It's that small of a town. And interestingly, that move also represented a big shift in my memory. I really remember very little of my life in the city. Honestly, it's almost as if an abrupt change just shut the door on my past experiences. Yet one of the few things that I do recall from those days of living in the city was that my mom took my brother and me to see the Ringling Brothers Circus in Manhattan. I think it was at Madison Square Garden, but I could be wrong there. And for lunch, she took us to a Horn and Hardart Automac cafeteria somewhere in that big city. I couldn't tell you where. What distinguished the Automat from all the other restaurant chains was its unique food retrieval system, which is probably the reason why I remember it so well. And maybe you've seen this in movies, but adorning the cafeteria walls were prominent signs like sandwiches, pies, bread and rolls, and so on, you know, basically telling you which section to go to. And beneath these designations, a myriad of small compartments just seemed to stretch endlessly, and each was equipped with a glass door, and that allowed patrons to peer inside and, of course, select their desired food items. Instructions on the wall of each automat explained exactly how it all worked. Quote, first drop your nickels in the slot, then turn the knob. Glass door clicks open, lift the door, and help yourself. Unquote. It really was that simple. Well, just a couple of weeks ago, I ventured into downtown Albany to attend a lecture at the New York State Library. And parking down there is always a nightmare. This is what's known as the Empire State Plaza. Sometimes you can park right near where you need to be, and sometimes you feel like you're a mile away. Anyway, this was a day that it was easy to park, and I was there way ahead of schedule. So I decided to ride the elevator up to the fourth floor of the museum library building. And while many flock there to take a ride on their amazing indoor antique carousel, and I do recommend you see that if you're ever in Albany. Anyway, my aim was not to see the carousel. I had a totally different thing that I wanted to see, and it was mounted right on the wall right near the carousel. What I was there to do was snap a photo of a set of cubicles that had been removed from a defunct automat. and I'll place a photo of that on my website. But what I hadn't anticipated was that the sign above the glass doors read, "Bread and Rolls." And as you'll soon learn, that was a perfect fit for the Automat story that I'm about to tell you. Well, at 9:15 a.m. on Wednesday, July 26th of 1933, there was a report of an elderly woman collapsing on the mezzanine level of the Automat restaurant, which was located on the southeast corner of 104th Street and Broadway in Manhattan. If you are curious, the restaurant did close in 1953, but the beautiful building still stands to this day. Anyway, less than 10 minutes after the call, an ambulance arrived at the scene. And without delay, the rescuers swiftly secured the woman onto a stretcher. But just as they prepared to lift her, a man rushed over and he reported seeing an unconscious man lying on the basement floor, not far from the bathroom door. Tragically, the man was pronounced dead at the scene. The woman, she was rushed off to Knickerbocker Hospital on Convent Avenue, where she would also die 1 hour later. Now, having two people die at nearly the same time at a restaurant is quite unusual. But the most baffling part of this was that they both died in nearly the same exact way. Pending autopsies, both deaths were initially classified as epileptic fits, which suggested possible poisoning. But the big question, of course, was how? You know, could the food of the restaurant have been tainted in some way? Well, Alfred Harvey, the manager of the restaurant, insisted that neither had partaken in any of the restaurant's food. But of course, this is in the days before cameras, and it's a crowded restaurant, and really you're not interacting with anyone, so he really did lack concrete evidence to support this claim. But here's another thought. Was it possible that someone, you know, slipped some sort of poison into their drinks? And if so, that meant that the police could be dealing with a case of double murder. Ooh. And then there was the question of whether or not these two knew one another, or, you know, possibly they were complete strangers. You know, could this have been a case of, you know, double suicide, or possibly a situation where one murdered the other, and that was followed by a suicide? Or maybe, just maybe, it was pure coincidence that the two died at nearly the same time with nearly identical symptoms. So what do we have? Lots of questions, and the police had very few answers. What I will tell you is that none of these scenarios is quite right. The man was identified as 50-year-old Henry Jelinek, and he had emigrated to the United States from Austria in 1896. He lived at 605 West 150th Street in Upper Manhattan with his wife Edna and their 18-year-old son Harold, who at the time was a student at New York University. Henry had started his career as a helper in a garage, and he was able to save up enough money to open his own auto repair business, which was located at 794 10th Avenue. His partner in that business, a guy named Adolf Schwartz, said that Henry had called him within the hour before his death to let him know that he was going to, quote,
have a bite to eat and would be down to the office in a few minutes.
Schwartz told police that Jelinek was happily married, he showed no concerns about his business at all, and he was generally in good health. In other words, there was absolutely no reason to suspect that he had committed suicide. Jelinek's sister, whose name remained undisclosed in the newspapers, told a reporter, quote,
my brother wouldn't do such a thing. He has a boy he loves, a fine wife, a splendid home, and there is no reason for his doing that. If they say he was a suicide, we will hire a lawyer and thresh the whole thing out.
The deceased woman was identified as 51-year-old Lillian Rosenfeld, although it was later learned that her legal name was Rosenfeld. Now, Lillian was familiar to both the employees and the regular customers at the Automat, as she often visited the establishment in search of food. Manager Harvey informed the police that he had thrown her out of the restaurant on multiple occasions because she was stealing food from the patrons. And while most believed that Lillian was homeless, she was not. She lived alone in a basement apartment within a brownstone at 119 West 104th Street, which was just a mere two blocks away from the Automat. According to Bernard Doherty, janitor of the building, people there knew her as Lillian Fields. he said that his predecessor had discovered Lillian sleeping in the hallway 3 years earlier. Taking pity on the penniless woman, he obtained permission for Lillian to sleep in that dingy basement apartment. But eventually she agreed to pay $7 per month so she could stay there permanently. Adjusted for inflation, that's about $165 per month today. The initial information gathered by investigators revealed that the victims were complete strangers to one another. They had dined on opposite sides of the restaurant with no observed interaction between them. And given the stark differences in their lifestyles, it seemed improbable that they had any prior contact. Acting Lieutenant of Detectives Charles Flood confirmed this.
We had been unable to find a single person who saw Jelinek on the restaurant balcony where the Rosenfeld woman collapsed.
Autopsies were immediately performed on both bodies. No signs of food were found in Jelinek's stomach, but there were these small black specks that were later identified as poppy seeds. And to no one's surprise, similar seeds were found in Lillian's stomach. Moreover, a chunk of poppy seed roll was found obstructing her throat. Chemical analyses further revealed lethal levels of cyanide in both stomachs. But get this. The concentration of poison in Henry's stomach was estimated to be 3 to 4 times greater than that found in Lillian's. It was now clear that both had been poisoned, but how and why? And who consumed it first? And I guess the bigger question is just how did it end up killing two people who had never met one another? Medical examiner Dr. Charles Norris was equally perplexed.
I don't know what to think of it.
He immediately ordered an analysis of the food samples from the restaurant, but I won't leave you in suspense on this. Nothing dangerous was discovered.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Further investigation revealed that Henry Jelinek's business had been having financial trouble, and this is something that his partner, Adolf Schwartz, had been unaware of. You see, business at the garage hadn't been going well, so Jelinek took out a loan for $150, which is about $3,600 today. Under normal circumstances, this really wouldn't be that big a deal, but keep in mind this is during the depths of the Great Depression. Henry really had no way of raising the money, and he misses July 1st payment date. As a result, the bank threatened him with foreclosure. It was also learned that Jelinek had been in somewhat poor health for several weeks. Investigators also discovered that 1 week prior to his death, Jelinek had gone to a local drugstore and purchased $3 worth of cyanide powder. That's around $70 today. Now, just how he was able to convince the druggist to make the sale, well, I have to tell you, that was never determined. Following a thorough investigation of all the evidence, investigators concluded that Henry Jelinek entered the automat on that fateful Wednesday morning intending to take his own life. He walked over to the brass and glass section with the bread sign above it, inserted his nickel, and purchased a plate containing 2 poppy seed rolls. You then calmly sat down at a table, pressed a hole in the top of one of the rolls, and then sprinkled some of the cyanide powder on top. He ate one half of that roll, and knowing that the end was near, he walked to the restroom in the basement where he ultimately collapsed and died. So that explains one half of the mystery, but we're still left with the question of how Lillian Rosenfeld fits into all of this. What Jelinek was unaware of was that Lillian, who had come into the restaurant in search of food, was seated at a balcony table watching the patrons below to identify those who left uneaten portions of their meals behind. When she spotted Henry Jelinek stand up from his table, Lillian swooped in like a hawk and she snatched the rolls that he had left on his plate. She then carefully placed the untouched roll, that's the one without the poison on it, into a paper bag, and then she consumed the remaining half of the poison roll, and that sealed her fate. As the expression goes, desperate times call for desperate measures. And in the harsh economic climate of 1933, Lillian Rosenfeld, like so many others, had no choice but to steal the table scraps left behind by patrons of the automat. And that cost Lillian her life. But did it really have to? Well, it turns out that Lillian had enough money to purchase her own poppy seed rolls at the automat. And I'm not talking chump change here. She had more than just a single nickel. A lot more. And I am not exaggerating here. When Lillian's body was first found lying on the automat floor, Detective Frank Walsh searched through her clothing to see if he could find some sort of identification. He was shocked to find a Metropolitan Savings Bank book that showed a balance of $4,000. Adjusted for inflation, Lillian had approximately $96,000 sitting in that account. Also among her possessions, the police found an address for her cousin Abraham Mannheimer, who operated a business at 369 7th Avenue. He was the one who led investigators to Lillian's basement apartment. And once the officers got inside, they were shocked by what they found. That's because Lillian had been living in appalling conditions. Her furniture consisted of a bed frame without a mattress, a couch thought to have been scavenged from a vacant lot, and a broken armchair. That's it. The June 1946 issue of Coronet magazine described her apartment as follows, quote, "In her filthy magpie's nest on 104th Street were thousands of cardboard boxes stuffed with oddments and crawling bugs. Peanut shells, gum and candy from the subway, bits of string, bits of paper, pieces of wood and coal, broken pens and pencils, old hats, single shoes, newspapers by the hundred gross, parts of sheets and blankets, old catalogs, broken furniture, and five old bank books," unquote. Summary, lots and lots of worthless junk that Lillian had picked up off the street. But did you catch that brief mention of the old bank books? I mean, what about them? Well, one of them contains a slip of paper that said, quote, "In case of accident to Lillian Fields, please notify Delia Rosenfeld of 38 West 126th Street. And that's exactly what the police did. Delia was Lillian's sister, although they had been estranged for years. Their relationship soured with the passing of their father, Simon S. Rosenfeld, in 1923. Essentially, their father, a prosperous real estate entrepreneur, bequeathed each daughter $15,000, which is approximately $273,000 each today. But afterward, Lillian accused Delia of being, quote, "too extravagant," unquote, and unfortunately, the two cut off ties with one another. Despite the widespread belief that Lillian had nothing and needed to scrounge for scraps of food, the reality, of course, was quite the opposite. When her estate was finalized a year later, it totaled $62,430.29. Now, adjusting for inflation, Lillian's assets surpassed $1.43 million. And while such wealth would be substantial in any era, envision its impact during the Great Depression. And just ponder this thought. Consider how Henry Jelinek's fate might have been altered had he possessed even a fraction of that fortune, just $150. One can only wonder if both Lillian and him may have gone on to live much longer lives. And I'm going to throw in one final factoid that I discovered while researching this story. When Mrs. Annie Stein died on July 24th of 1921, her will set up a $10,000 trust fund for her two nieces, Delia and Lillian Rosenfeld. Now, $10,000 in 1921 is over $172,000 today. But there was one big catch. Get this. The sisters needed to remain unmarried. As long as they remained single, the two would split any interest earned. But as soon as one of the sisters married or died, the other received the $10,000 principal. And while there's no documentary evidence to support this, I think it's safe to assume that Delia became the beneficiary of this trust fund. She was unmarried when she died in 1965, and she's buried in the Baltimore Hebrew Cemetery, as are Lillian and their parents. Useless, useful, I'll leave that for you to decide. So, after hearing that story, do you think a crime was committed? As I said at the very beginning, I'm still not sure. Now, I've known the story for a number of years, but I honestly never considered recording it. I just figured it's such a great story that every true crime podcast out there would have already covered it. And I don't know, for some reason, a few weeks ago, I decided to do a search and see if anyone had done so. And to my surprise, no one had. So I just figured I should be the one to tell it. Just a reminder to hit subscribe and leave a favorable review of this podcast in your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the podcast on both Facebook and X, which I still prefer to call Twitter. If for some crazy reason you'd like to contact me, whatever that reason may be, my email is steve@uselessinformation.org, and there's also a contact form on my website, uselessinformation.org. Now, if you've never been to my website, you really should check it out. There's a wealth of information there. And just a couple of weeks ago, I came to the realization that I started that website back in 1994, which means that it's now 30 years old. Hard to believe. And I have to say, it's changed quite a bit over all that time, but much of the original content is still there, although you do have to hunt for some of it. The Useless Information Podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, so be sure to visit airwavemedia.com where you will find a curated selection of some of the best podcasts out there. As always, thanks for listening and take care, everyone. Bye.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that because you're already listening to a podcast.